like a bubble into a cavernous chamber in the nose of the former propellant tank. The briefing center's dome-like interior had been painted with stripes of black and white that converged on the point of the nose cap. Jamie hovered in midair, blinked several times, and realized that the wall he had come through had become the floor of the briefing center. The flat surface was studded with plastic footloops, further defining it as the floor. The black and white stripes provided strong vertical orientation. With up and down clearly defined, Jamie felt somewhat better. He reached out a hand as he approached the curving wall and pushed himself lightly back toward the floor. Anyone can be an acrobat in zero gravity, Jamie realized, or a ballet dancer. Slowly, 16 queasy, faintly green scientists gathered on that floor, anchoring their boots in the foot loops, their bodies hunched forward slightly in what was called the zero-G crouch, their arms floating weightlessly up around chest height, like polyps attached to the sea bottom, Jamie thought, weaving back and forth in the currents. Dr. Lee, clad in sky-blue coveralls with a stiff collar, stood on a slightly elevated platform at one side of the circular area. Not that he needed a platform with his height. In contrast, most of the astronauts and cosmonauts gathered around him were quite short, Jamie saw. American or Russian, most of the flyers had the sawed-off physiques of fighter pilots. Lee looked pretty green himself, Jamie thought. The expedition commander waited a few moments for the assembled scientists to quiet down. Then he began, in his thin, high-pitched voice.
Believe it or not, we are now going through the most difficult part of our mission.
I believe it,
someone muttered loud enough for everyone to hear and laugh at.
In a few days more, we will become accustomed to microgravity. In a few weeks more, we will transfer to Mars spacecraft, which will eventually be spun up to simulate terrestrial gravity, and then despun as we approach Mars to acclimate us to Martian level of gravity.
Lee looked pallid, drawn, yet his face was puffier than it had been on Earth. His eyes seemed narrower. It struck Jamie that if they maintained zero-G all the way to Mars, they could save tons of food. No one would have much of an appetite. But we'd be in no condition to work on the surface once we got there.
In a moment, I will introduce our astronauts and cosmonauts to you. Then we will break up into smaller groups to become better acquainted. However, first I wish to remind you of a very sensitive and very important point, a subject that you have all discussed individually with the physicians and psychologists. It is mentioned, but only briefly, in your mission regulations books.
Lee took a deep breath.
I refer to the subject of sex.
Everyone took a breath, like a collective sigh wafting through the group. Jamie could not see the faces of the other scientists without turning his head, which would bring on a wave of nausea. But the astronauts and cosmonauts were facing those scientists, and Jamie saw a couple of grins and even a frown.
We are all adult, said Dr. Lee. We all have healthy sex drive. We will be living together for nearly 2 years. As your expedition commander, I expect you to behave in adult manner. Adult human beings, not childish monkeys.
No one said a word. There was no laughter, no giggling, not even a cough.
Men outnumber women among us by 4-1. I expect you men to behave sensibly and to keep the goals of the expedition above your personal desires. Dr. Reed and Dr. Yang, our two physicians, have medications that will suppress the sex drive. You can go to them in complete privacy and confidentiality if you need to.
Jamie wondered how much privacy and confidentiality there could be among 25 men and women locked inside a pair of spacecraft for nearly 2 years. Lee looked over his assembled team members, then added,
I want to make it quite clear that neither I nor mission controllers will permit sexual problems to interfere with success of this expedition. If any one of you cannot control his sex drive, he will be required to take medication. Is that clear?
What about the women? Jamie wanted to ask, but he did not. The image of Edith flickered in his mind, but he found himself turning his head ever so slightly to look at Joanna, standing just off to his left in the row ahead of him.
Very well, then. I will now introduce the men who will pilot our spacecraft and be in command of our various teams once we reach Mars.
As Lee began to introduce the astronauts and cosmonauts, Jamie wondered what would happen if a man made trouble and then refused to take the medication he was ordered to take. What can I do when we're millions of miles out in space? 2. After the introductions, the group broke up into smaller units. Jamie joined his fellow scientists and the two men who had been appointed their pilots and commanders. They were assembling along the curving wall at one end of the platform, where Dr. Lee remained. The scientists moved cautiously across the loop-studded floor like men and women in a dream, or drunks who were trying to maintain their dignity and self-control. Jamie saw the astronauts and cosmonauts casually pushing themselves off the walls of the floor itself to glide effortlessly toward the little knots of scientists gathering to talk with them. Insolent grace, Jamie thought. It was a line from a story he had read years ago, in freshman English. One of the Russians floated by overhead, grinning wolfishly as he looked down at the lurching, wobbling scientists. Insolent grace. Jamie made an effort to reach Joanna. He came up to her side and touched her on the shoulder of her coveralls. She jerked with surprise, then paled noticeably and put a hand to her mouth. "I'm sorry," Jamie said in a low voice. "I didn't mean to startle you." Joanna swallowed hard, the hint of tears in her eyes.
"One moment. I will be all right,"
Jamie said. "I just wanted to thank you for helping me to get here. I'm very grateful to you." Her face still pale, she replied.
"It was necessary to remove Professor Hoffman. He would have been impossible."
"I'm very glad to be here," Jamie repeated. "For whatever part in this you played, muchas gracias." She smiled faintly and replied in Portuguese,
"Okay."
Then she turned away from him and went to stand beside Ilona Molitor, tall and regal-looking, even in plain beige coveralls. The scientists attached their feet to the loops on the floor with the clumsy care of newcomers. The Russian cosmonaut and American astronaut, both dressed in tan slacks and pullovers, hovered effortlessly before them. The four scientists, geologist, microbiologist, biochemist, and physician, finally got themselves settled in the foot restraints and focused their attention on the astronaut and cosmonaut who would be their team commanders.
"I am Mikhail Andreevich Vosnesensky," the cosmonaut introduced himself. "I am command pilot of the first landing team."
He spoke English perfectly, without any trace of an accent, in a heavy voice almost in a bass register. He looked to Jamie like Hollywood's version of a Russian. Short, thick torso and heavy limbs, dark reddish-brown hair, beefy face with skin so fair it was almost pink. He reminded Jamie more of a stubby character actor than a hotshot rocket jockey. "I'll have to check his biography in the mission records," Jamie said to himself. While Vosnesensky's eyes were the clear, bright blue of a summer sky, innocent, almost childlike, the expression on his chunky face was dour and brooding.
"And I'm T. Peter Connors," said the black American astronaut with a good-natured grin. "My official position is pilot, safety officer, and second in command."
Connors' smile was charming, but his red-rimmed eyes looked somehow sad, wary. Not more than a centimeter taller than the Russian, Connors was much slimmer, sleeker. It made him look almost lanky compared to Vosnesensky, like a racing thoroughbred standing beside a plow horse. His voice was not as deep as the Russian's, but richer, more resonant, like a singer's.
"I want to make one thing clear at the outset," Vosnesensky told the four scientists, almost growling. "I am not here to be your friend. I will be in command of your group from the instant we enter the Mars One spacecraft here in Earth orbit until the instant we leave it, once safely back here in Earth orbit. Especially during the time we are on the surface of Mars, my responsibility will be to see that all mission objectives are met and no one is hurt. I will expect my orders to be carried out without delay and without argument. Mars is not a university campus. We will maintain military discipline at all times. Is that clear?"
"Quite clear," answered Tony Reed.
"Any questions?"
No one spoke. No one even moved as they stood anchored to the floor by the foot restraints.
"Good," said Vosnesensky.
Connors added,
"If you have any problems, we can always talk them over. We'll be in transit for more than 9 months.
That's the time to go over the mission plan in as much detail as we can and hash over any changes you want to make.